All right, welcome to a brand new episode of No More Heroes. I'm your host, Andy Malafrina. Today we have a very special guest, the very talented Ken Silva over at the Libertarian Institute and HeadlineUSA.com. Ken, how are you doing today, dude?
Oh, I'm doing really well. Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I was I was very excited to talk to you. I've been pretty pumped because I've heard you on Scott's podcast. I've heard you on Jose's podcast. I was like, this guy has definitely caused really increased my schizophrenia. and like, it was funny prepping for this interview because I was like, I was going through your articles and stuff, and I was like, dude, I was telling my wife right before this, I was like, dude, I don't know where to start, because if you look at like the new, like some of the newer stuff you posted, it's like Biden-backed regime murders American journalists, 4 undercover FBI agents targeted autistic teen, like Jan 6 journalists given probation for entering cab, and like, I guess like my thing is, because I'm into all this shit, you're obviously into all this shit, you know, you write about it, and I think like some people a lot of times like, they sense the shit. They sense the shit and they're like, I'm not going to touch that. And if it's like, they can kind of tell, like, it's hard to keep your fucking head on straight. So I guess as the journalist, you know, before we get into actually talking about the content, as the journalist that actually like, this is what you do every day. Like, I read it because it interests me, but like, this is what you, like, what do you do to keep your head on straight when like, just knowing all this shit?
Well, I don't know. I kind of find it like an entertaining pastime. Like, it's better than paying attention to sports or whatever. I mean, I'm from Cleveland, so I've had like 3 decades of misery there. So instead, I just track, you know, informants and terrorists and Nazis and then things like that. And like the real life stories, as you know, you've talked to Jose about the Oklahoma City bombing, like, this stuff is actually really interesting. And so like, it's kind of like reading like a real life spy novel. So like a lot of people, yeah, it could take you to a dark place, but if you try to, you know, detach yourself, that definitely helps. But then again, when you actually talk to like the victims, like I talked to a grandmother of two babies who died in the OKC bombing, and like just talking to her, like really messed me up for a couple of days. So, you know, there's good days, there's bad days, but overall, it's a dream job, to be frank.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that like kind of what you? How did you get into talking about the FBI specifically? Because I like, that seems like, that doesn't seem like where everyone starts. Like, were you going down a path of certain journalism, and then the FBI? You started getting to the FBI stuff, and was like, oh, this shit's wild.
That's pretty much exactly what happened. So I was like an 18, 19. In 2008, during the Ron Paul campaign, and I got super deep into libertarianism. That was around the time of the financial crisis, so I was more into like the theory. Like I read all like a Rothbard, the Austrian business cycle, trying to figure out what happened with the economy. And then in the mid 2010s, around the time the Epstein stuff and the Trump campaign, I guess I kind of just drifted into the more like the deep state conspiracies. And during this whole time, I'm just working for like local newspapers. I'm not doing any national writing. And then it wasn't until 2021, working remotely, and I took a second job for the Epic Times, which is like this giant conservative newspaper. And that's when I started writing about more national topics. And I was reading a book called Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, which you've probably heard. It's the mega biography on Timothy McVeigh. Kind of raises questions about whether he might have been some kind of MK Ultra victim or subject. And I start looking up names from that book in the federal court system just to see where these guys are now, if there's possibly any stories out there. And I searched Jesse Trinity's name in the court system and found out that he had an open lawsuit against the FBI. And I started looking in this case, and it's just like the most incredible story I ever really read. And that's all about, you know, his 20-year quest for his justice for his dead brother and how that relates to the bombing. So I did my first initial story on his open lawsuit in early 2022. That ran on the front page of the Epic Times. It's pretty cool. They have like 500,000. That's like their print circulation. And yeah, from there, I kind of I guess, the right-wing extremism and how it interplays with the FBI. That kind of became my specialty, or my beat, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's interesting. Yeah, and what was it like kind of like getting deeper into, because I was going through your Fed File series, which is on Headline USA, if anyone wants to check that out. It's very interesting. And it's like, it reminded me of like when I first started getting into the FBI stuff, and you kind of have this moment where you're like, wait a minute, that's not real. And you're like, that's not real. And do you still like deep into doing this reporting? Do you still have moments where you're surprised, or is it kind of like, yeah, I thought this was happening?
Well, the last time I was really surprised was reading Aberration, and that was in the fall of 2021. And I had already, like I said, I already been a Ron Paul guy, a libertarian for like 12 years or so. And that book kind of really shocked me, just to the extent of, I guess if you want to call it the deep state, how evil it really is and how they really might be committing terrorist attacks on purpose to discombobulate the population and sow like some kind of discord for whatever reasons. I'm not exactly sure, but ever since I read that book, nothing really surprises me. Things still definitely disgust me. Like I've reported the last year, I've done like 5 separate stories on the FBI grooming and then entrapping teenagers on terrorism charges. And so that definitely makes me mad, but nothing really surprises me anymore. I guess it's just like Murray Rothbard had a quote, something along the line of anger is my muse. Like he would see whatever is in the news that day, and that would inspire him to write his essay for the day. And that's kind of my philosophy too. I just try to find the stories that I guess anger and shock me the most, and then distill them, and hopefully, for readers to be able to understand what's going on. Hopefully,
yeah, that makes sense. Cause I find myself the most engaged I am with political shit is when I see someone and like they'll be saying some nonsense, and it gets you gassed up. And then that's like the best I am at learning about new shit is when I'm like, dude, I'm gonna tell this guy he's wrong.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't lose any arguments. That's definitely a good motivation.
Yeah, because it feels when you're coming from like a more libertarian perspective, it feels like it's like you have to understand what they think and also know the facts, and it's just like it feels like a multi-layered process. Have you in your writing like what like have you like in doing writing about, say, like, I guess, like, I know you've done a bunch about the Oklahoma City bombing. Have you had something in that process where you're like, you wrote this shit and then you're kind of like, oh, I like added to the general narrative of how we kind of like understand this?
Yeah, I would like to think I did a couple good stories that I don't know if it adds to the narrative of how we understand this, but Well, I've done a couple of stories like that, but the biggest story I broke was this this transgender terrorist who became the first inmate in history to get a sex change funded by the taxpayers in prison. And the reason I did that is because, like I said, I was reading books about the Oklahoma City bombing, and one of McVeigh's associates was a guy named Peter Langan, who was the head of the Aryan Republican Army, and which was like this giant bank robbing terrorist group. And the thought is that the proceeds of their robberies help fund McVeigh and, help fund the actual attack itself. And when they arrested Peter Langan in 96, they found that his pubes were totally shaved. He had a painting on his fingernails. And I guess he was like a closeted a cross-dresser even back then. And just a really interesting character. His dad was in the CIA. So I looked him up in the court system and saw that he had a lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons suing to get a sex change, claiming that it was a violation of his Eighth Amendment rights to not have access to gender dysphoria treatment, as he called it. So I broke that story, and he became the first, like I said, the first inmate in history to get a sex change. And I don't know if that adds to the overall OKC narrative, but I think it was a way to get the story back in the news. Like all the Republicans read it and get outraged over inmates getting sex changes, but maybe one or two of them actually read the whole story and was like, whoa, wait a minute, this Langan character, he was like a Secret Service federal informant that went rogue. So hopefully a couple people saw the story and got into like the deeper aspects of OKC because of like that salacious, where are they now type story.
Interesting. Yeah, no, because it is. I was just curious about that, because I always like wonder what it's like being in the middle of writing a story where, because like as the consumer, I get it when it's nice and polished, but you're like just digging through all the shit. And so is that how it kind of works, where it's like you see a name and then you're just kind of like, let's see what's up with this.
Yeah, that's basically my method. Like I'm a state school kid that don't really have any deep sources in the government who are feeding me information. So it's kind of like you just read and look up current names. You just make connections just by doing it every day for years. And, kind of like how Scott Horton became a foreign policy expert. He was just like a taxi driver. But if you interview people every day for a decade, of one day, you actually become fairly competent with the material yourself.
Yeah, that makes sense. No, that makes sense, because I remember, I have those random moments where, now obviously I'm not sitting here saying I'm a fucking expert or anything, but you have those random moments where it's just like, I'll listen to podcasts all the time, and then someone will bring something up, and you're like, oh, wait, I actually, like, know about that. So it's just... So like you're not trained in any way. It's just from the repetitions.
I studied political science in college and became a journalist instead of going to law school because I was lazy. So it was basically, training on the job. And yeah, like I said, after 10 years, I broke a bunch of pretty big stories on the local level, and I think that training helped me. Hopefully, I would like to think be able to present these kind of conspiracy cases and more of like a news, like easily digestible sixth grade reading level type stuff. That's like kind of my goal, is how to present the information in a digestible form.
Oh, nice. So you've been doing this for, like you said, over a decade. And I remember a big thing, because I was learning a bunch. I was learning a bunch about the FBI. I did an interview with Radix about the Gretchen Whitmore case. So I was like getting deep in the FBI, and I remember I hit a point where I was like, do they not do anything helpful? And I'm like, oh, I'm talking to Ken today. He's like the FBI expert. And like, I guess that's the question. Like, do they, I think some people don't fully realize, like, do they do anything helpful?
The FBI has a really good reputation for like solving white collar cases of like fraud and things like that. I mean, they do legitimate work, but I guess that's the nefarious aspect of that. I guess I make the analogy to like calling the New York Times fake news. Well, 99% of the stuff you read in the New York Times is going to be pretty factual and accurate, but it's like, the most important stuff is what they mispresent or twist or spin for political purposes. And the same thing with the FBI, like they probably do a lot of legitimate cases on the lower level where it's like helping local law enforcement solve murders. But at the very top, they're used as a tool to crush dissent on the left and the right. And it's just like a giant national police force. Like I'm sure the KGB probably arrested a few murders in Russia during the Soviet Union, but that doesn't change how we think about the KGB.
So I guess the question would be to that, like, if it's just, because you were saying about reading Heartland of a Real, what's the title of the book again?
Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, Secret Life of Timothy McVeigh.
That's right. So you were talking about reading that, and you were talking about, you know, based off the information you got out of that, you know, it made you realize, like, the FBI has the capacity to do some insane shit, but also at the same time, you know, it, you know, you're saying it's like, you know, bits and pieces here and there. I guess, like, a question a lot of people would have is, like, through, because whenever you talk about conspiracies, you think it's, like, every single person's involved, and it's every, like, everyone at the FBI gets in a meeting where they go, all right, this is how we're going to fuck over the Americans today. But, like, the actuality is you just need, you don't need a shitload of people. So I guess there's a disconnect, I think, with a lot of people. Like, how are they able to cause so much harm? But, like, you could conceivably see that most of the FBI could be out of the loop on that.
Yeah. I think the domestic terrorism operations unit, I think it might have changed its name by now, but that's the section of the FBI that really does a lot of these sketchy, you know, kind of borderline entrapment cases. And it's probably pretty compartmentalized. I mean, I did a story last year where we figured out that one of the undercover agents involved in the Whitmer case earlier that summer was infiltrating Black Lives Matter groups and trying to get them to assassinate Colorado's attorney general. Again, I just got that story listening to Trevor Aronson's podcast on, it's called The Alphabet Boys, and it was about the BLM movement of summer 2020. And he starts talking about this undercover agent Red, and that kind of rung some bells. We got a description of a guy. We got audio files. That turns out it's like 99% for sure the same guy. I mentioned that to, you know, hammer home the point that, like, yeah, there were two entrapment cases on total opposite sides of the political spectrum, but there was only one agent involved in both. So they probably have a select group of guys who are willing to do these kind of cases.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now that makes sense, especially too, like, I'm assuming they lack a lot of oversight, so it's easy to get away with that stuff. Yeah. What else did I want to add? Oh, I saw this other story I was very intrigued in, and I heard a little bit about it. But it doesn't seem, you had this story about, what's his name? Gonzalo Lira. Who is a U.S. journalist who ended up dying in a Ukrainian prison. I thought it was interesting because I haven't heard a lot about this, and that seems like a big deal. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about that.
Yeah, sure. I could give you the basics. I'll insert the caveat that, like, every day I do four or five stories about what I think's important in the news. And I don't go super deep in every story. I kind of try to clarify what I'm an expert on and what I'm not. Like the Fed file stuff, I would say, yeah, I've done tens or hundreds of hours investigating, like, Pat Conn and the Fed files. The Lira case, I just know the basics is, like, he's an American journalist living in Ukraine. Early 2022, Russia invades, and he starts becoming a blogger in Ukraine who is saying, hey, the facts on the ground are that Russia, they're going to dominate Ukraine. Tens of thousands of people are going to die if we try to really fight this war. And also Zelensky's corrupt. He gets arrested once, released, and he was trying to get out of the country, but he was apprehended before he could do so. He goes to prison and nobody hears from him for about 6 months. And then he turns up dead. Just recently, I guess his father said that he was having all kinds of health problems in prison, and the authorities weren't giving him proper medical attention. So it really looks like this guy, he was telling the truth. The Zelensky government didn't like it, and they purposely took him out with the tacit consent of the Biden administration. I don't know if this is has any weight or not, but I know his father alleged that, yeah, he was talking crap on Kamala Harris like the day before he was arrested or something. So there's kind of a feeling that the Biden administration also had knowledge, and if not tacit approval, they might have even actually pushed to have been taking this guy, you know, off the playing field.
Oh, really? Okay. And yeah, if you make, I feel like too, if you mix that with the fact that they don't want any bad PR for Ukraine, I could see there being an immense lack of energy going in that direction.
Yeah, especially they don't want anybody on the ground in Ukraine because that lends that person extra credibility, and he could obviously, you know, report firsthand on what's going on.
Okay, gotcha. So yeah, okay. So you mentioned the Fed files, which I did. I did dig into those articles a little bit, and yeah, I think one of the big takeaways I got from that, where it would just be like you'd bring up a group like the NSM, and then you know they'd have ties, like the formation would have ties to the FBI, and then you'd bring up like Charlottesville, and that would have like sort of ties there, and then you talk about Patriot Front. Is it safe to assume that the vast majority of any of these type of political or like quasi political organizations has like some sort of like FBI infiltration in them?
Oh yeah, most definitely. I mean, in like the 60s and 70s, I read one statistic. It was like 20% of the Ku Klux Klan were FBI informants. And it was so commonplace that there was actually a joke among the KKK. It's like, how do you spot the FBI informant? Well, he's the guy who's actually paying his dues on time. So this is like a long, long history of this. And it's all like the notion that the FBI's budget or that its network of informants has shrank since the 60s is totally absurd. Like it's probably exponentially grown due to 9/11 and just, you know, the overall climate of terror. So, yeah, I think it's very safe to assume. And I wish I would have it off the top of my head, but there was a Newsweek article a couple months ago where an FBI official off the record was admitting that they're infiltrating MAGA and Trump groups ahead of the election, you know, obviously to fortify the election, according to the Newsweek story. But that really stuck out to me. There was actually a quote where Newsweek, the journalist, said, the FBI, they're infiltrating MAGA groups and they're going to be doing some controversial things, like kind of referencing like COINTELPRO in the 60s, that they're actually going to be trying to disrupt these groups from within. So like MAGA is really mainstream, and the idea that the FBI is infiltrating them is pretty scary because, you know, in the 90s and before that, at least, like Nazi groups and KKK and Black Panthers, there's a little bit of a criminal element there. A lot of the informants came from prison. You know, they have prior drug convictions and the FBI turns them and sends them back into the group. But now we're talking about these same tactics employed in, you know, mainstream groups where like everybody has day jobs and most of the people have their shit together. It's just like this whole PatCon is becoming really mainstream, and it's pretty scary, I think.
Yeah, and I think I remember reading somewhere like basically after September 11th, it was mainly focusing on like Muslim and Middle Eastern people, and I feel like it's substantially shifted towards, yeah, like the MAGA crowd and stuff like that. So it's, yeah, there's going to be a much more, what do you think? I don't know. What do you think, like, the, because we've seen like the whistleblowers come out and kind of talk about how they're focusing on that. They're going to like, they're focusing on parents at PTA meetings. Is there a general, this is what we're doing at the FBI, or is it like a lot of people, you know, everyone's doing their own thing?
No, this is a top down policy. Merrick Garland, the attorney general, who, by the way, was involved in Oklahoma City, but that's an aside, as well as Chris Wray, the FBI director, they both say the white supremacist domestic violence is the greatest terrorism threat to the homeland. Although I think Chris Wray did shift slightly after the Hamas attack. He's just saying now, you know, there's threats everywhere. We're all doomed is basically the government's position. But yeah, this is a real top-down policy. And I think the January 6th cases, you know, they're still arresting people every day just for trespassing on Capitol grounds now. You don't even have to have gone into the building. And a lot of the Trump people are saying like, oh, this isn't fair. They're trying to persecute us for supporting Trump, which is definitely true. But the reason why they haven't closed these cases yet is because as long as January 6th is still an open investigation, you know, millions of dollars of resources are being poured into those kind of cases. Like, I think January 6th is basically PatCon in action. It's like, okay, we're still investigating this huge insurrection. We're going to devote many undercovers, agents, the wiretaps, blah, blah, blah. Like, the January 6th case is their justification for running a modern day PatCon. In my opinion, that's like speculation, but I think it's informed speculation.
And wait, crap. I might be exposing. I didn't research enough. Can you go down what PatCon is again?
Okay, so yeah, PatCon, it was a 1990s era undercover FBI operation, which entailed undercover FBI agents posing as Nazis. They called themselves the Veterans Aryan Movement, which you might notice bears a striking resemblance to the Aryan Republican Army, which is that bank robbing gang affiliated with McVeigh, run by the transgender who's now in prison. So PatCon was based on that. These undercover Nazis would go around the country fomenting violence, trying to get people to like poison water supplies or attack a nuclear plant, blow up federal buildings. It directly coincided with Ruby Ridge, Waco, and the Oklahoma City bombing. And this program wasn't revealed until like the late 2000s, but it's a lot of people, including myself, suspect that the Oklahoma City bombing might have been some kind of operation within like a PatCon type like major investigation. And now I think most people on the internet use PatCon as shorthand for the FBI infiltrating right-wing groups. It's basically the right-wing version of COINTELPRO. So when I say PatCon, there's a specific operation in the 90s that's a reference to, but it's just like a shorthand for right-wing infiltration.
Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. Sorry, when you brought up Oklahoma City, have you ever, this is just a quick aside. Have you ever heard of the podcast, Last Podcast on the Left?
I've heard of it, but I've never listened.
Yeah. Because Oklahoma City bombing's one where I go, I always look at it and I go, there's a bunch of weird shit, but I personally, I don't know if I've done a deep enough dive into it. Like, I don't know the alternative, but they have, if you have the time, they have an episode about Oklahoma City bombing and their way of explaining how the explosion happened, talking about like there's this air phenomenon where if it gets sucked in the right way, and I was just like, and then what, it blows up a whole building, dude?
Well, okay, so I think what they're referencing, I'm more of a John Doe 2 guy. I think there was an accomplice who was probably a Fed. The question about explosions, I know Jose from the No Way Jose podcast, he talks about that a little bit more. I think that's unprovable because, you know, we could excavate the Oklahoma, you know, that's a memorial site now. You could excavate it and see if there's like explosive materials in the soil. I don't know if that would work 30 years later, but they'll never let you do that because you're best basically it would be desecrating a memorial. But with John Doe 2, I'm still writing about that all the time because that's possibly we could figure out who John Doe 2 is. But you were talking about the blast, and I think what the Last Podcast on the Left was probably referencing is the building kind of blew out. And so people are like, oh, the explosives had to be on the inside. But the Ryder truck, when it explodes, it creates a vacuum where there's no air. And so all the air rushes to fill the back vacuum back in. And so the air from inside the building rushed out to refill the vacuum around the truck. And that's why the blast pattern looks like it was exploded from the outwards. And so I think they might actually have like a valid point there if that's what you're referencing.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay, fair enough. And I do enjoy, shout out Last Podcast on the Left. I do very much enjoy them. I just crushed their series on the Manhattan Project. So, but I remember listening to that just being like, I don't know, that sounds nuts. But then on the flip side, that's the hardest part. That's actually why I took a break on OKC, because it was like you'd hear something and you'd be like, that sounds nuts. And then everything just feels like it turns into a dead end, because like you said, with the soil, no one's going to fucking let you go in there. Does that part of the job, I feel like you have to run into that constantly, where you're just like, you hit a point where you go, oh, there's like, I think a lot of these things, but there's never going to be a way to actually prove that. Is that, does stuff like that get super frustrating?
Yeah. Well, it's even more frustrating when you actually do prove some deep, deep corruption in the FBI, like nothing happens. Like I have phone numbers for a couple congressmen or their communications people, and I'll send them some stories and just nothing ever gets done. I mean, obviously it's pretty absurd to expect that Congress would open an investigation to Oklahoma City at this point. Like the Republicans would just get raked over the coals as crazy conspiracists. So that'll never happen. And that's a little disappointing. Sometimes I'm like, okay, am I just writing for a little pocket of the internet that's like interested in this case as a pastime? Or am like, is that anything actually going to be done here? But as far as like hitting dead ends where like, you know, something, but can't report it. When it comes to like Oklahoma City bombing, there's tons of actual unreported evidence that you could sink your teeth into. So there's like, I really haven't been presented with a problem as far as that goes.
Oh, really? Interesting. Interesting. What have you been, I saw you were doing a lot of reporting on, the Jan 6 stuff. And like you were saying before, they have been, I feel like a lot of people don't know about that. Like they have been laying down substantially heavier sentencing for like Jan 6 participants. Like you did the report on the journalist. He was just like walking around the place. Like, do you think this is sort of a method of like sending a message to people to be like, yo, you guys don't want to be a part of this? Or like, what's the move on that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not exactly sure what's going on there. I know, so the DOJ is the one pushing for harsh sentences, and a lot of the times the judge doesn't give the DOJ what they're looking for. So yeah, the DOJ wanted to put that journalist in prison for 10 months, and the judge, to his credit, he should have tossed the whole case out. Let's get that out right in the open. But he gave him probation instead. But what's behind the DOJ's effort to give as harsh a sentence as possible just could be, you know, them responding to incentives, where if a prosecutor puts somebody in jail, they get a pat on the bat and on the back, and you know, they'll possibly get a promotion in the future. It could be something as simplistic there. I mean, the DOJ, they're the hammer and everybody else is the nail. So I'm sure that happens in all kinds of cases. Although to your point, they did drop charges against like hundreds of rioters from the summer of 2020 protests. So yeah, I don't know exactly what's going on, but it could just be as simple as, you know, personal incentives.
Yeah, the disparity between the treatment is kind of fascinating, because yeah, you saw some like BLM type rioters. That, like, some of them were like getting let out that night to be like, yo, have fun, dude. And then like these guys, you'll have a grandma who like walked around and she's in solitary confinement or some shit like that. It's interesting. It's fascinating. You were just talking about like, you know, they're doing stuff to get a pat on the back, get a promotion. I see that a lot of times, like whenever you watch any of those documentaries about different court cases, you have an overzealous prosecutor who's like, I need to get my numbers up. So they, you know, they're kind of have blinders on. it's like, and this kind of goes to your point where it's like there's a couple people at the top and everyone else is just kind of going along with the thing. And it's like, do you think the FBI is sort of, I think I remember reading this somewhere where it's like they've sort of just become a victim of their own bureaucracy where they have to, you know, they have to validate their own existence. So is that, it, does that give them incentive to then like make stuff up? How, or you know what I mean? Kind of like, fudging the numbers with a lot of these groups and stuff.
Oh yeah, most definitely. If they want to keep getting tens of millions of dollars, like they got to be solving cases. You can't just go up to Congress and say, "Hey, thanks for the giant budget, but you know, nothing really happened this last year." So yeah, there's certainly a heavy incentive to kind of foment and manufacture these kind of cases. There is a real politic like rationale for it. If I were to give the FBI the benefit of the doubt, the most compelling case or the most compelling reason I've ever come across for why that they have to do these kind of things is because if the FBI doesn't, a foreign government will. And that, not to like scaremonger like Russia or anything, but like these Nazi groups on the fringe in America, they will get help from wherever they can. There's even a random case from the early 2000s where one guy started corresponding with the North Korean government, and he was like some Nazi, you know, whatever, what antecedent to the Proud Boys, low IQ guy, but he was into like the North Korean system of government because he saw their dictatorship as kind of like a good right-wing strongman type of thing to aspire to. And the North Korean government made him like a poster boy. They started putting him on North Korean newspapers, like, oh, look at this handsome white guy from America who thinks North Korea is the best. And he became like an asset of the North Korean government. And so the FBI began investigating this guy and affiliated Nazis as a result. And yeah, I guess that long-winded story I just told is to say that, like, yeah, foreign governments will cooperate with local Nazis if the FBI doesn't co-opt them first. That would be the best, I guess, rationale for these kind of cases that I've come across.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So if the government, if our government doesn't go in there and sort of wrangle these Nazis, and a foreign government could go in and do the same thing, and then they don't have sort of they don't have any tabs on that. How do you you said he was a subset of the Proud Boys? I missed that part. I'm sorry.
I forget the group. It was like 2002. Saying he had nothing to do with the Proud Boys, just to clarify. I'm just saying it was like in some kind of like these right-wing edgelords.
Yeah. He was similar to, but yeah, Proud Boys were way later.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was like a group like that, but they formed a study group to study like the North Korean Juche ideology. That was the particular group. I don't know what the group was off the top of my head, but that's the point I was trying to make.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I just wanted to clarify because I was trying to get a grasp of like their size. And then I look at that and I go, how do you, I don't know if you know this answer, but how do you like contact the North Korean government? Do you just, you know what, as I'm saying it, you probably get in contact with like someone on the low level and they throw them up the chain of command or something like that.
Yeah. So the story I'm referencing, I just looked it up. It's called White Power and Apocalyptic Cults, Pro-DPRK Americans Revealed. It's on nknews.org. And yes, like John Paul Cupp is the guy's name. He was 22 years old, a fundamentalist, son of a fundamentalist Christian preacher. And one day he receives a message from the government of North Korea. So they actually reached out to him when they realized what he was doing. And it kind of grew from there. It's really a wacky case, but it ties directly into the right-wing extremism and the FBI's infiltration of these groups.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Is there anything you're like looking at that makes you sort of like, cause you know, you've been saying you're deep into the FBI stuff. You're like a fucking expert on it basically. Is there anything like, do you kind of see patterns and anything coming in the future, or I don't know.
I couldn't predict the future. I think they're going to come up with something. Who knows what they're doing, but I'll just reference back to that Newsweek article where they're actively infiltrating MAGA groups as we speak. And I know there was a report about a year ago, I think like a couple thousand tons of ammonium nitrate went missing off of a train. That was, of course, the same material used in the Ryder truck. I try to keep an eye on a few things that might be happening, but I guess, unfortunately, we're all just kind of reactionaries to however they try to screw us over next.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Fair enough. I just, you know, it's like sometimes you see certain stuff in the news happen and you're just like, oh yeah, no, that's like, you probably have a great radar for that, where you're just like that. Like, I remember I was listening to you on, I think, Jose's podcast, where you were talking about like Patriot Front, which actually I think I saw you said shifted from one of the groups that was involved in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's just probably a great fucking radar on that kind of stuff. What else did I want to ask you about? Oh, I know. I was saying on, have you been keeping track of the Gretchen Whitmore case?
Pretty closely, yeah. I'm not as an expert of it as Christina Radix is, yeah. But that's one of the cases I would say I'm pretty competent in.
Okay, because I was very intrigued on that one, because that gave me a very clear picture on like how sloppy the FBI could be. And I was wondering if like, I saw they had a lot of verdicts. Didn't like most of the dudes get off on most of the stuff?
So of the people who actually went to trial, half of them have been convicted. Initially, there were the people on federal trial for actually allegedly conspiring to kidnap Whitmer. Two of them were initially convicted. There was a retrial for the other two. And then after kind of a show trial, the other two were convicted and put in prison. Then there was a state trial in late 2022 where three people were found guilty. But then there was another state trial just late last year, and all three of them were acquitted. So that's 5 and 5 so far, which is a terrible track record for the government, by the way. Usually their conviction rate is like 95%. So.
Yeah, so that's an impressive lack of information. That's like an impressive amount of lack of information on that one. If they're, you know, if it's going down that hard, with all you know about the FBI, did the Whitmer case kind of like, did that? I feel like that one might have even impressed you, where you're like, damn, that was such little shit.
Or the Whitmer case is really important to me. Because like with January 6th, everybody still has, you know, free will, even if it's some kind of Fed entrapment, color revolution, like what they did with Ukraine in 2014. Like people still had the choice of whether to actually go in the building in the name of installing Donald Trump as their, you know, God King or whatever. I don't think anything should happen to these people, really. Give them a slap on the wrist. That's pretty much it. But I also don't agree with their motives. Like, I don't like Donald Trump either. But like the Whitmer guys, like, these are our people. These are libertarians who were against the lockdowns, who were just trying to form militias because they were living amidst, you know, tyranny, to be frank, and plus civil unrest, like people burning down cities. And they didn't take any overt criminal steps. They were just caught saying stupid things by informants over the wiretap. So to me, it's a much more nefarious case. It shows how the FBI is kind of ever present in the country, and you got to watch what you say at all times. And I also think the militia people, like, they, you know, they weren't even attempting to commit any supposed crime. That was a particularly disgusting one. And yeah, a lot of information came out of that case where it's like, okay, PatCon is most definitely still running to this day.
Yeah, and the government definitely, that seems, maybe it might just be kind of like the things I'm looking into, you know, reading about OKC and stuff like that. But it seems like, for probably obvious reasons, it seems like the government has a huge dislike of militias and stuff like that. That seems, how much of a focus do you think that is on the FBI? Is that like a big concern of theirs?
It certainly is now, and it has been pretty much since the late 70s to early 80s. There was a right-wing terrorist group called The Order in the 80s, which was actually, as far as I can tell, pretty organic, where these Nazis affiliated with militias went around robbing banks, and they used the proceeds to give to groups like the KKK and Aryan Nations. And the government responded to that with PatCon and all these really sketchy cases. So ever since then, they kind of created a counterterrorism apparatus to take down the Order, but it's just grown and mutated from there and become totally corrupted. So yeah, if that answers your question, I think it's definitely probably because of the Order, and it's gotten totally out of control.
Okay. Yeah, no, it does seem, you know, it would make sense too with, you know, fucking how they're reacting to the MAGA people. Like they're the ones with the guns, the overreaction to fucking everything. Yeah. Is it like, do you think it's like a legitimate paranoia? Cause it almost makes me think about how they felt about communism back in the day before the Cold War ended, and how they would like go to different places when they'd see a little bit of communism flare up. Is it a sense of paranoia, or are they just, I don't know.
A sense of paranoia on the part of the government.
Yeah, on the government, just seeing like, oh, this group that loves guns is definitely getting a little bit too in favor or whatever. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, you could, there's a lot of plausible theories. Like obviously if they get the militias out of the way, that's could be arguably the last resistance to tyranny, just make us all serfs, take away all of our guns. I don't know if there's anybody in a smoke-filled room that's actually articulating that specifically and saying, hey, we have to take out the militias. They could also be like easy boogeyman, where the left hates militias. So if the FBI and groups like the ADL and Southern Poverty Law Center inflate that threat, they get the left wing on their side, and they, you know, all the benefits that goes with that.
No, that's a good point. And you bring up the Southern Poverty Law Center. It reminds me of, like, it almost makes me think akin to the bureaucracy of the FBI, where, like, you could have some motherfucker in the FBI who just wants a fucking promotion. And so, and if he's just locked in on that promotion, he could do some of the most evil shit.
Yeah. And
then, yeah. So they just be, go ahead.
So in the Whitmer case, there's a lot of like the grand theory would be, oh, this thing dropped in October. So some smoke, people in a smoke-filled room obviously plan this as an October surprise to make Trump look bad. Say, oh, these militias, they're out of control. These are Trump's people. You know, we got to do something in the name of restoring democracy. But if you look at the individual incentives level, one of the agents, the lead agents in that case, had a private cybersecurity company, and he, like, this company had a Twitter that was making these cryptic tweets like, oh, there's some news coming soon about the governor, and like really, you know, breaking a lot of rules there, but before any arrests were made. And he was basically using the Whitmer case to drum up business. He had plans to retire after the Whitmer case and start a cybersecurity business, and use that off the backs of the Whitmer defendants. So I think, yeah, people, not only for promotions, but for financial ends like that.
Yeah. And I think that's what people in my, in people in my sphere who I'm like, oh, I got to figure it out. I got to figure it out. You got to remember, it's like you said, it's probably, it's some dude who just wants to big up his cybersecurity firm or whatever. It's like, it's not always, yeah, it's not always the puppet masters and shit,
yeah,
like that.
It's, the banality of evil, I think, is the term. It's like, it could be more boring than you might think.
Well, I think that's another thing I've been thinking about, where it's like, it's weird. Like the FBI stuff, on one hand, it is all fucking nuts. But then on the other hand, there's this weird dichotomy where you're like, it also reveals how boring life is sometimes, where you're like, oh yeah, that thing, because you in your Fed files, you have your article about the Charlottesville thing, where correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there was certain things organized that was like in association with the FBI, like organizing a protest, or maybe not Charlottesville, but in spots they've had protests where you have the FBI working on a right-wing protest, then there's other FBI groups working on the counter protests, and you're just like, oh wait, that wasn't like, so it becomes the craziest shit where people are going back and forth, someone gets hit by a car, but it's also just completely fucking made up.
Yeah, and the banality of it all is, so in the Fed files, I found an interesting, a guy pretty much made the case that these FBI agents just do it for overtime. So there was a 2005 protest in Toledo that was kind of like a microcosm of what would happen in Charlottesville in 2017. You had Nazis going in Toledo. Then there's something called the Anti-Racist Action, which was like a precursor to Antifa. The FBI kind of told both groups to be there at that time. They clashed. There was violence. And the cops, they all got overtime pay. They got to like work on a weekend and get extra money. And so it was like as simple as that, where like if we throw these idiots together, they're going to get violent. It's going to be a major case and we're all going to benefit from it. It's like the incentives are very perverse.
Yeah, that's fucking nuts. Dude, that would suck so hard. You're just in jail. Can you imagine like you went to jail for a while and then a couple years later they're reading one of your articles and they just find out, they're like, oh no, an FBI agent got me all worked up over bullshit.
Oh yeah, and that's really where the disgusting and the disturbing element of it comes in to me. Like the federal prison is the most hellacious institution I've ever written about. It's like anything they tell you about the Soviet gulags, like we have that here in states like Indiana, Illinois, Maryland, like New York City Correctional Institute. Like these places, they'll throw you in a tiny 9x9 cell that gets like 100 degrees in the daytime, gets down to like 30 degrees in the wintertime, cockroaches, feces flooded like through the toilets. Like it's just really disgusting. And they're entrapping people and sending them there because these are like so-called political prisoners. Like the people getting charged with murder get treated better. It's the people that they want to shut up and prevent from talking to the public that they throw in the most horrific prisons just to like lock them up and like make sure the people totally forget about them.
Lock them up, forget about them. But then, oh, so they probably give them like crazy long sentences, right? So they're like never to be heard from again.
Yeah, usually there's like terrorism enhancements in a lot of these cases. It's called a communications management unit that they send so-called terrorists to. And that's where they heavily manage the communications, as the name would suggest, where they're you're only allowed to talk to your attorney or a mother, maybe. And everything is just really, really heavily monitored, even more so than a normal prison.
Damn, that's crazy. I never even thought about that. Cause yeah, like why does that, I feel like that like never gets talked about. Like what is there limitation to like how journalists can get in there, or cause I just feel like that's never talked about.
Yeah. It needs to be talked about a lot more, especially on the right wing. I think, you know, the law and order mentality, like these criminals kind of deserve to be in there. That was the feeling in the 20th century. And then after 9/11, we started sending Muslims there, and nobody cared about Muslims either. And now right wingers are getting sent in these communications management units. And now finally people are starting to notice. It is very difficult to do journalism on these institutions because they won't let reporters inside. There was even a case to tie this back into the Oklahoma City bombing. Terry Nichols, the guy who allegedly helped McVeigh build the bomb, but he didn't bomb Oklahoma. He was in Kansas on the day of the attack, but mm-hmm. they sent him to one of these facilities in Florence, Colorado. It's Florence ADX, the Supermax, where the Unabomber was, Ramzi Youssef, like the first World Trade Center bomber, like the worst of the worst, you could say. And Terry Nichols was scheduled to go on 60 Minutes, I think in like 2001, and he was supposedly going to spill some serious beans about, you know, possibly John Doe too. And at the last second, the prison kind of cut off all communications and declared it like a national security threat if Terry were to talk to 60 Minutes. So that's just to give you an idea of how these prisons are basically black boxes to the outside.
Yeah, and I was reading your in your Fed Files article, they were talking about what's the guy's name? Something White? Paul?
Yeah, Bill White. Just for your listeners, Bill White. The Fed Files are underpinned by hundreds of court documents that have been filed by a prison inmate who's also filed records to support a lot of his allegations, that basically all his buddies in the Nazi movement were informants. I guess that's the Fed Files in a nutshell, just to interject that.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Bill White, I remember the one part that really stuck out to me when he was talking about how they were treating him. He was in like you said, a 9x9 cell. And the one that really stuck out to me is they kept the lights on for like 100 days.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember I was listening to you talk about it, or I forget if it was you talk about it or I read it. No, I think I was listening to you because I'm playing a video game while listening to a podcast. And then I just kind of stop and I'm like thinking about that. And it's like to the point where it's like you can't even if you cover your eyes, and you're like, it's just that for, what's that, 3.5 months? That's fucking nuts. So even if like some of these guys get in there forever, even if you come out, like you're probably coming out whacked out of your head because they've been torturing you for a couple decades.
Oh yeah, he got PTSD from that, and that's one of the things that is 100% proven, that he obtained like prison records that were monitoring his sleep during that time and filed them as evidence. So like this isn't just him alleging it in a lawsuit. Like we have records where we know that this is how he was treated. And yeah, he slept for an average of like 1 hour, 5 minutes a day for 3 months.
That's crazy.
He said he like tried wrapping himself in a mattress. And yeah, that's the kind of stuff that actually does mess with my head. Like this is the kind of country we live in. And it's happening to the Whitmer guys too. Christina was talking to those guys in a Michigan jail, getting statements from them on the record for Congress. And she gave one of the statements to me and I published it on Headline USA. And the very next day they were sent from Michigan jail to Supermax in Florence, where Terry Nichols was. And that's like headlineusa.com. I work for a pretty obscure, small little like right-wing media, like clickbait type publication, but they're monitoring it and they got so upset that they immediately sent these people to, you know, the little cages where now we haven't heard from them since. I mean, it's really dark stuff.
Yeah. And that's why I always like, I'll see some dudes online. They'll be getting a little wild with their tweets, and I'll be like, dude, don't give them a reason. Oh, don't give them a fucking reason. And to that, I think this is a great place to wrap it up, but I think to end out, like what would be a good safety guide if, say, you're one of these guys, you just want to go out on the weekend with the boys and practice a little, you know, let's do a little tactical whatever the fuck. Let's practice a little. What are like the key signs your buddy might be a Fed.
Well, I mean, the obvious one is if they suggest anything illegal. I mean, that's pretty low hanging fruit there. But as far as like advice, just try to do it with if you have childhood buddies or your family or something like that. I mean, that might not be good advice either, because I guess we have to learn to trust each other if we're going to, you know, build some kind of community outside of the state. But yeah, I don't have really any warning signs. Sorry, I can't give better advice. But yeah, just don't. Yeah, don't even talk about doing anything illegal. That's probably the best advice I can have. I think the boomers were really affected by that, because part of our culture as like white people from the Midwest is 1776, the founders, insurrection. Like that's part of our heritage, and they're using our heritage against us. Like in the 90s, it used to be perfectly appropriate to say like the tree of liberty needs to be watered with the blood of patriots and tyrants. But now the prosecution will use a statement like that in court to argue that you're a terrorist. So I don't have any good advice. It's disgusting. Yeah, I'm sorry that it's happening, but I guess everybody should just, yeah, talk about the NFL or something mundane like that. I don't know.
Just watch football, keep your head down.
Yeah, just barbecue and chill out.
Hell yeah, man. So yeah, you can catch Ken over on Headline USA, the Libertarian Institute. Is there anywhere else you want to send people?
No, that's it. I guess JD Cashless, JD underscore Cashless on Twitter.
Hell yeah. All right, man. We're going to get out of here. Ken, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Yeah, my pleasure. I really appreciate it.